Gildan Media presents Your Coach in a Box, affordable, life-changing audio programs.
What Love Is and What It Could Be, written and read by Kerry Jenkins. For Philosophy with Love. P.S. We need to talk. Prologue. On being a philosopher in love. Maybe. I am a philosopher. I am also a human being. These aren't wholly separable aspects of myself. They are intimately connected. They inform and shape each other. How I love influences how I think, and how I think influences how I love. I'm not unusual in this regard. Anyone who sets out to think about love comes to the task with a bundle of personal experiences. Whether good or bad, stereotypical or subversive, our experiences inform our thinking. And there is nothing wrong with that, which is lucky really, as there's certainly no escaping it. We just need to be aware that it happens. On the mornings when I walk from my boyfriend's apartment to the home I share with my husband, I sometimes find myself reflecting on the disconnects between my own experiences with romantic love and the way romantic love is normally understood in the time and place in which I live, Vancouver, Canada, in 2016. Sometimes this starts out in my mind as a replay of an awkward conversation, one of those where someone's asked me a perfectly innocent question, "So how do you two know each other?" and unwittingly forced me to choose between giving a deceptive answer and providing what I know will be too much information. If I tell the truth, he's my boyfriend, to people who know me and my husband, it's inevitably going to cause embarrassment. The kind of embarrassment that comes with suddenly being made to acknowledge the existence of something awkward, something abnormal, something that makes people feel icky. Deceptive answers, "Oh, he used to work in the office upstairs from mine," are easy and comfortable. And it turns out, it's alarmingly easy to be dishonest while saying true things. He really did work in the office upstairs from mine. That just isn't how we met. In fact, we never met in person until we noticed each other on the dating website OkCupid. When I am tired or nervous, when I don't know the person I'm talking to very well, or when I just don't feel like explaining myself again, I take the easy way out. I give the deceptive answer. But philosophy doesn't let me take the easy way out of hard questions. Living in this cultural context, I'm routinely reminded that successful, mature romantic love, the stuff of movies, pop songs, Valentine's Day cards, and fairy tales, is supposed to be monogamous. So the question is forced on me, what is this thing that I'm doing? Is it love? Is it romantic love? Philosophy is my day job, and I know a philosophical question when I see one. But reading the philosophical literature on love hasn't, on the whole, been much help to me. Philosophers often assume monogamy without question. Some even treat monogamy as definitive of romantic love, a characterizing feature that distinguishes it from other kinds of love. No doubt these philosophers are guided by their own experiences, which create and sustain their baseline assumptions. But philosophy no more allows our baseline assumptions to pass unchallenged than it lets us take the easy way out of hard questions. If indeed romantic love must be monogamous, then I am making some kind of mistake when I say, "I'm in love with you," meaning romantically, to both my partners. I am not lying, because I am genuinely trying to be as honest as I can. But if romantic love requires monogamy, then despite my best intentions, what I'm saying at those moments is not, strictly speaking, true. The question of whether what I say is true is complicated, not least because the nature of love is a vague and messy business. Answers are not going to appear neatly tied up with a heart-shaped bow. We can and should trace out the broad-brush contours of love, but if we go looking for sharp edges, a tidy, simple theory, we're bound to be disappointed. Trying to state the nature of romantic love with precision is like trying to nail some jello to a wall made of jello, using a jello nail. But the question is complicated for another reason as well. Romantic love is in the process of changing. And I don't just mean that attitudes towards love are changing, although that's also true. I'll unpack these ideas over the course of this audiobook. For now, though, suffice it to say that I think the norm of monogamy could be one of the features in flux. We are creating space in our ongoing cultural conversations to question the universal norm of monogamous love, just as we previously created space to question the universal norm of hetero love. Just having the words to describe something is an important first step in opening up that space. A word for honest, non-monogamous, loving relationships, polyamory, came into circulation during the late 20th century. Since the 1990s, the internet has also greatly facilitated the exploration of polyamory and other forms of ethical non-monogamy, as distinct from cheating and other unethical behaviors. This has made it infinitely easier for those who wanted to explore non-monogamy to find like-minded partners, communities, and information. Over the same period, researchers have begun to work on understanding the stigma attached to violations of the monogamy norm, while activists and advocates have begun to work on ending that stigma and providing practical information and support to people whose families or jobs are at risk because of prejudice surrounding their non-monogamous relationships. One can track the effects of all of this in various cultural barometers. Dan Savage, one of the world's most famous and controversial sex and relationship advice columnists, is one such barometer. Over the last few years, Savage has started to take the possibility of mature, successful, non-monogamous romantic love very seriously, having previously been something of a doubting Thomas on the question of whether people in poly marriages ever made it to their third anniversary. Themes and questions related to modern polyamory have also started to appear at the more thoughtful end of mass media. In the Spike Jonze movie Her, for instance, a computer operating system claims to be in love with 641 people. She attempts to explain to one human lover that the heart's not like a box that gets filled up, it expands in size the more you love. It's too early to say where this conversation will go. I think romantic love might expand to include non-monogamous love as part of a general trend towards greater inclusion. It's not that a norm of non-monogamy would replace the norm of monogamy, any more than a norm of non-heterosexuality is replacing the norm of heterosexuality. Rather, the scope of what counts as romantic love would become more inclusive. But I don't see this future as a done deal. It's not even as close to being a done deal as the inclusion of non-hetero love. And all this means that I am unsure whether non-monogamous love is really romantic love, whether being in love in that sense with two people is really possible here and now. I think love can make room for non-monogamy. But of course, I am biased. Then again, everyone is biased. Perhaps it would be safer to say that I hope love can make room for non-monogamy. A more inclusive picture of love would make better sense of what's happened in my own life than the image I grew up with, which made romantic love the property of straight, monogamous couples only. In any case, I am prepared to bet that, from a biological perspective, what's happening in my brain looks the way romantic love is supposed to look. In fact, it's partly for that reason that I think romantic love could accommodate non-monogamous love. Romantic love has a long history of breaking free from social constraints, and biology has played a part in that. But the interplay between love's constraints and its freedoms is complicated, as is the interplay between love's biology and its social profile. On those mornings walking home, I came to realize that in order to understand whether I was in love or not, I'd have to work on untangling some of these complications. I couldn't think of a better approach to the problem than to search for an answer to the philosophical question, what is romantic love? This is what I meant when I said philosophy doesn't let me take the easy way out. My efforts developed into this audiobook, but the project quickly outgrew its original purpose of helping me figure out whether I was in love. It has ended up being all kinds of other things I never anticipated. This isn't an audio program about non-monogamy per se, although it sprang partly from questions I have about that. Love turns out to be philosophically fascinating for all kinds of reasons I could never have imagined. This is a short audiobook. But even so, it'll take us into the realms of medicine, magic, queerness, wisdom, dopamine, gender, Romans, rainbows, rationality, Sappho, soulmates, politics, and of course, human nature. Buckle up. Eventually, this audiobook became an exploration of possibility. What love could be, not just what it is. I ended up with a theory that makes romantic love partly, but not entirely, a social construct. The social aspect of romantic love changes over time, but social change is often slow, especially when it comes to something so invested with value and significance as love. Change doesn't happen overnight. and a single individual can't bring it about. That said, some changes happen quickly enough to be visible in the course of a lifetime, and we do live in interesting times in this regard. I often wonder what it would take for one particular change, the inclusion of non-monogamous love as normal, to happen. It would have to become unsurprising to see a romantic comedy that ends with a happy romantic relationship among three people, or to hear a pop song about the trials of navigating simultaneous open relationships. In other words, becoming included is a numbers game. Exposure to just one example of successful non-monogamous love may be enough to challenge prejudices, but it would take exposure to many and varied examples for non-monogamous love to start to become an acknowledged normal option. I don't see this happening anytime soon, although I would be happy to be proved wrong. In this audio program, you will hear my theory of what love is and what it could be. It's a theory that explains why representation in mass media is so important to non-traditional love, and why we encounter such visceral resistance from the people who want to keep it off our screens and out of the minds of the children. The crux of the matter is that the representation of romantic love in our cultural products is no mere shadow or reflection of what love is. What we see on our screens, hear on our radios, and read in our magazines is actually part of the process of constructing love, making love what it is. These acts of representation are part of how we collectively create and sustain the contours of romantic love's social profile. The stakes are high, and I'm personally invested, as are you. Just as we all bring our experiences with us, and just as we are all biased, we are all personally invested. Nobody is agenda-free, and there's no view from nowhere when it comes to love. It's just that when your view from somewhere isn't one of the normal ones, you are forcibly and frequently reminded of its existence. For a philosopher, these reminders of one's own perspective are invaluable, which is not to say they're always nice. Calling ourselves objective doesn't make us any less biased. In fact, there is some evidence that it may make us more so. Being normal doesn't mean you have no perspective and no baggage, although it does mean you're less likely to notice these things. In any case, we can't make genuine philosophical progress on the hard questions by stuffing our personal baggage behind the sofa of objectivity and hoping nobody looks there. The best we can do is try to maximize our awareness of whatever it is we're bringing along for the ride. Introduction. This sense of wonder is the mark of the philosopher. Philosophy, indeed, has no other origin, and he was a good genealogist who made Iris the daughter of Thaumas. Plato, Theaetetus. My day job as a philosophy professor consists of thinking, writing, and talking about, as well as teaching, philosophy. I have been a professional philosopher for 10 years. Before that, I studied philosophy for 7 years. Those 17 years comprise my entire adult life. But as is the case for many people, my childhood was full of philosophy too. I just didn't know it was called philosophy back then. Like a lot of kids, until adults tell them to cut it out, I asked questions about the nature of reality as soon as I could entertain them. I wanted to know what existed, what the world was like, and what was possible. When we wonder what love is, that's part of the philosophical enterprise. More specifically, it's part of metaphysics, the ongoing project of trying to figure out what is real, what the world is like, and what is possible. There is more philosophy going on in people's everyday lives than you might think. Is love real? What is it like? What is possible in the realm of love? These are deep and old metaphysical questions. And for a few years now, I've been captivated by them. I never planned to work on love. I started my career thinking about the philosophy of mathematics. But love snuck up on me and wouldn't let me drop it. The mind wants what it wants. I'm particularly fascinated by romantic love. That's not because I think other kinds of love aren't interesting or important. They certainly are. But our current state of information has landed us with particular philosophical challenges and puzzles when it comes to understanding the nature of romantic love. These puzzles hit me in the heart first, but they quickly took root in my intellectual life as well, connecting themselves in fascinating ways to the other philosophical questions I work on. This part shouldn't have come as a surprise. Philosophically, it's always been my experience that everything is connected to everything else. That's part of why I love philosophy, a discipline where nothing is, in principle, irrelevant. As my thinking about love gradually drew in ideas from other areas of philosophy, I was delighted to find they seemed to be just what I needed to make better sense of love. While the nature of romantic love is a perennial philosophical question, today we are confronting new and immediate pressures to find answers. But doing so can appear less feasible than ever because we also face some especially difficult choices right now. In particular, we face a stark choice between treating romantic love as a biological phenomenon and viewing it as a social or cultural product. Wikipedia can be a surprisingly good gauge of situations like this. To some extent, it tracks the pulse of our current state of public information. As I was writing, the Wikipedia entry for love described exactly the choice I had in mind. Biological models of love tend to see it as a mammalian drive, similar to hunger or thirst. Psychology sees love as more of a social and cultural phenomenon. Certainly, love is influenced by hormones, and how people think and behave in love is influenced by their conceptions of love. This is actually a great summary of the problem. Some leading theories of love tell us it's a biological phenomenon, while other leading theories, here attributed to psychology, but also coming to us from a number of other disciplines, tell us it's a social and cultural phenomenon. There seems to be at least a grain, and perhaps much more than a grain, of truth in both pictures. I believe we can build a philosophical theory that accommodates both the biological and social natures of romantic love. It just takes some conceptual work to see how it all fits together. But the intellectual, practical, and personal payoffs are worth the effort. Many philosophers of love treat it as a psychological or mental phenomenon, often as an emotion of some kind. I don't think this is the whole story, as we'll see. In any case, the philosophical problems that strike me as most urgent right now have to do with untangling love's biological and social aspects. So while I'm not setting the psychology of love aside, it will keep popping up throughout this audiobook, I've set my sights on questions that point both within and beyond psychology. If the history of popular culture in the last half century is anything to go by, questions about the nature of romantic love are very important. Several pop songs and albums have What is Love as their exact titles. Hadaway's 1993 power ballad is perhaps the best known, and my favorite. And then there are variants like the Foreigner song, I Want to Know What Love Is, and the Cole Porter Show number, What is This Thing Called Love? There are many, many more in the same vein. When a theme is this pronounced in popular culture, that tells us something. We are seriously fascinated and confused by this thing called love. It's worth pausing here to notice how often, in these songs and everywhere else, people say love when they mean romantic love. That's convenient shorthand, but notice how it also suggests romantic love is accorded a special place in our thinking. Anyhow, I'll use it myself. Unless I specify otherwise, you can assume that love means romantic love throughout this audio program. While this fascination with figuring love out is completely contemporary, it is anything but new. The ancient Greek philosopher Plato was obsessed with love of all kinds, not least the kind he called eros, passionate love or desire, which he thought of as something that normally occurred between an older man and a younger man. In Plato's famous Symposium, the character Aristophanes expounds a myth about soulmates that sounds like it might be an early theory of romantic love. The story goes that once upon a time, humans were a species of two-headed, eight-limbed creatures. But they attracted the wrath of the gods, and so to punish them, Zeus split each creature in half. Some split into one woman and one man. Others split into two women or two men. The nature of love, according to this myth, is a striving to reunite with the person who is literally one's other half. A much more modern storyteller, contemporary writer Simon Rich, says that the Aristophanes myth leaves out the vast majority of humans. In his very short story, The Children of the Dirt, Rich calls the woman-woman pairs children of the earth, the man-man pairs children of the sun, and the mixed pairs children of the moon. But he goes on to say that there were also the children of the dirt, who only ever had one head and four limbs. They did not get split in half, because Zeus decided they were in enough trouble already. Today, Rich writes, the vast majority of humans are descendants of the children of the dirt, and no matter how long they search the earth, they'll never find what they're looking for because there's nobody for them, not anybody in the world. It's true that the Aristophanes myth ignores a lot of single people, both miserable and contented ones. In another respect, though, it is striking to modern ears how inclusive the myth is. The idea of a single creature splitting into two women, two men, or one of each is an attempt to theorize same-sex love right alongside opposite-sex love. We are only just catching up with the 2,000-year-old methodological insight that this might be a good idea. The myth of soulmates still makes for a great story, with or without Rich's modern edition. But nowadays, we don't give it much weight as a realistic explanation of what love is. These days, instead of turning to myths and legends, we look to our own modern oracle, Google. And Google, in turn, looks back, watching what we ask for, tracking levels of public interest in what is questions. Unsurprisingly, what is love is constantly at or near the top of the list. This search for understanding is not simply a quest for intellectual satisfaction, like solving a crossword. Not knowing what love is makes us deeply vulnerable, because love matters. Many people make their most significant life choices on the basis of whether they're in love or think they are. Saying, "I love you," is a big deal, and it is worth making every effort to figure out what it means. We can't afford to risk talking past one another or being badly misunderstood in some of the most important conversations of our lives. And yet, people routinely do take that kind of risk. They say, "I love you," without thinking or talking about what it means to say those words. In some of the worst-case scenarios, as bell hooks has warned in her book All About Love, unclarity about the nature of love can lead to mistaking abuse for love. Other people get through life and love just fine without thinking much about what love is. But a little reflection would take some of the luck and risk out of this situation. And what does it say about modern life that so many people's biggest decisions are based on the imagined presence or absence of something so poorly understood as romantic love? It means we have normalized two halves of a situation that, when we stop to think about it, should not strike us as normal. On the one hand, we've accepted the idea of love as a tremendously significant social force, something that shapes and reshapes the entire trajectories of lives and serves as a focal point for all kinds of values. Many of our most strongly held personal, ethical, and political beliefs cluster around our attitudes towards romantic love. Think about it. You can learn an awful lot about someone's worldview by learning what kinds of love strike that person as normal, natural, or valuable. On the other hand, we have simultaneously normalized the idea that love is a mystery, something hard or impossible to comprehend. We as a society cannot even agree on the fundamentals of what love is. In fact, we sometimes revel in or glorify this very lack of understanding, as if incomprehensibility were actually part of what is special or valuable about love. I call this phenomenon the romantic mystique. The idea of a romantic mystique takes inspiration from an older idea. In 1963, Betty Friedan noticed that people were simultaneously mystifying and glorifying femininity. She called this the feminine mystique, the idea that femininity is so mysterious and intuitive and close to the creation and origin of life that man-made science may never be able to understand it. Femininity, so conceived, is supposedly special and different from masculinity, but not inferior. According to the feminine mystique, the root of women's troubles in the past is that women envied men. Women tried to be like men instead of accepting their own nature, which can find fulfillment only in sexual passivity, male domination, and nurturing maternal love. The romantic mystique, as I see it, has a lot in common with the feminine mystique. The romantic mystique tells us that romantic love is also mysterious and intuitive and close to the creation and origin of life, yet special and wonderful partly for that very reason. The romantic mystique likewise encourages us to accept love's nature passively and uncomprehendingly instead of trying to resist or alter it. It is a disempowering ideology that celebrates ignorance and acquiescence. With love, and with women, there is cultural potency to the idea that mysteriousness is part of what is special about them. And the connection is no accident. There is a deeply embedded perception that romantic love falls within the sphere of women's concerns. Think about the gender balance among readers of romance novels, or what we count as a chick flick, or which gender is associated with all the pink and fluffy fripperies of Valentine's Day paraphernalia. It's no coincidence that love and women have been placed on the same side of the mysterious versus comprehensible divide. And it's probably not a coincidence that some of the most powerful contemporary work on what love really is and why answering that question matters so much comes from a feminist author who also works on gender, bell hooks. Hooks is interested in all kinds of love, but love within romantic relationships is prominent among her concerns. She thinks we need a definition of love, particularly one that clarifies that love is incompatible with abuse, because lacking a definition, we run a serious risk of mistaking abusive situations for loving ones. I'm not sure it's exactly a definition that we need, but the gist of this thinking resonates with me. To acquiesce or even revel in our own lack of understanding of love is not just intellectually unsatisfying. It exposes us to risk. It means refusing to arm ourselves with the knowledge and skills we need to stay safe and make good decisions. It means we are failing to understand a lot of what goes on around us day to day and are paying the price for that, whatever that price may be. When something is dangerous but insidious, just identifying and labeling it can be half the battle. That's why I want to start some conversations in which we can discuss the romantic mystique by name. Treating love as massively important yet totally incomprehensible shouldn't strike us as normal. It is a disaster. We're basing some of the key decisions of our lives on something we treat as an inexplicable mystery. Why aren't we more worried about this? One thing that I suspect is propping up the romantic mystique is a fear that overthinking it will have negative consequences for our own love lives. Perhaps we fear that understanding love too thoroughly might make us bad at loving. Perhaps we worry that we'll lose faith and become cynical about love if we think too hard about it. Because many hold love to be extremely valuable, anxiety about losing it or screwing it up by overthinking it will be a powerful motivator not to do too much thinking. But things that motivate us not to think are dangerous. John Shand, who teaches philosophy at the Open University in the United Kingdom, has argued that because our everyday ways of thinking about love are contradictory, we risk destroying the love that we value by the mere act of applied analysis. He tells a cautionary tale about the dangers of overthinking it. Look at it too closely, and thereby reveal the paradoxes involved in love, and love fails to work its magic. Many loving relationships, I suggest, involve a suspension of disbelief, useful fictions. Do not think about it too hard. Do not take it apart to see what is really going on, and one will find that it works. This, I suppose, must be true to Shan's experience. Yet he says that his theory is derived significantly from the phenomenology of love as encountered in our lives, where the first person plural suggests that Shan thinks his experience is shared. But my experience is not like this at all. I have not found that thinking carefully and philosophically about love has caused it to evaporate. On the contrary, it's made me feel safer and more confident, aware, secure, and genuine in my own relationships. It's also made love and life more interesting. I'm just one person, but then again, so is Shand. Perhaps you're more like me in this regard, or perhaps you're more like Shand. If you're more like me, you're probably already more worried about the tangible dangers of underthinking than about the putative dangers of overthinking. But if you're more like Shand, perhaps I can say something to alleviate the worry. In fact, let me try two approaches. First, any kind of love that would not survive a long, close look may not be such a wonderful thing to have in your life after all. Things that disappear when you look too closely often were never there in the first place. That's how illusions and tricks of the eye work. Perhaps you're thinking you'd rather be blissfully unaware, but ignorance is no guarantee of bliss. Illusions are unstable things that can crumble for all sorts of reasons and without warning, even if you studiously avoid looking at them. Here's a second reason not to be afraid of philosophizing about love. Philosophy is about forming one's own opinions through careful thought, not absorbing someone else's. I don't expect you to agree with me about love by the end of this audiobook. But that aside, I won't be trying to convince you that love is unreal, or contradictory, or illusory. My philosophical thinking suggests romantic love is very real, and I don't think we were ever in any danger of analyzing it out of existence. Love is complicated and confusing, sure, and we need to sort out a number of philosophical problems about it. But the theory I'm offering is a theory of a real thing. In the end, I am not cynical about love, though I would say I am careful. But it's important to be careful. Love is an extreme sport, and we don't skydive without parachutes. In my work, I'm influenced by a tradition in philosophy known as analytic metaphysics. Metaphysics is philosophical inquiry into what reality is like, and analytic metaphysics aims to proceed in such inquiry by deploying careful, rigorous argumentation and critical reasoning. Analytic philosophy has its roots in the work of thinkers like Bertrand Russell, G.E. Moore, and Ludwig Wittgenstein, who were prominent professors of philosophy at Trinity College, Cambridge, during the early 20th century. As I studied philosophy at Trinity College during the 1990s and early 2000s, this tradition heavily influenced my intellectual development. Analytic metaphysicians spend their working lives attempting to better understand the nature of reality. We try to be careful in our thinking and clear in our writing, and to question assumptions however natural they feel. These days, not very many analytic metaphysicians are working on love. But I think this is just a kind of historical accident. Analytic metaphysics has trends and fashions, and the metaphysics of love hasn't been fashionable lately. But love occupies the entire careers of other scholars, artists, writers, and thinkers. I've been influenced by much more of that intellectual heritage than I could ever discuss in a short audiobook. Choosing material to include was more like curating an interesting exhibition than composing a definitive index. Whatever the current trends, Bertrand Russell, a founder of analytic philosophy, had plenty to say about love, sex, and marriage. Engaging his analytic skills, he stood ready to challenge the prevailing assumptions on these subjects and tried to follow evidence and reasons where they led. His conclusions were so radical that he eventually lost a university position in the United States after being pronounced morally unfit for the job. Radical thinking is not always the safest or most comfortable life choice. My training gave me a set of techniques, a toolkit for careful, rigorous, honest thinking. Not the only such toolkit, but a powerful one. Used to its fullest potential, it can be radical, and it can be costly. But I couldn't trade it in for an unquestioning mind. That carries its own costs, and in my estimation, they are much higher. This audiobook, then, is an invitation for you to join me at the front lines of the philosophy of love. It comes with a starter kit, philosophical ideas, strategies, arguments, and theories. You might find you agree or disagree with what I say, but it is in that very process of agreeing and disagreeing that philosophers develop and refine ideas, pushing the questions a little further and deeper with each step in the conversation. Philosophy is a massive, ongoing, collaborative human enterprise, and I hope you join it. For my part in this collaboration, in this audio program, I offer my own theory of love. The main idea is that romantic love has a dual nature. Right now, we are witnessing the simultaneous development of convincing social and biological theories of what love is. Theories that make love a social or cultural construct of some kind have been around for a while, albeit with significant variation and development. Biological theories feel like a newer phenomenon, and indeed, in their current incarnations, they are new, though they have older precedents. But recent work in neuroscience makes it possible to construct a biological theory of love with genuine plausibility. And the arrival on the scene of viable biological theories of love forces a question: is romantic love really a social construct or a biological phenomenon? At this point, our two theories of love become an embarrassment of riches. We start with the question, what is love? We're told that love is biology. We're also told that love is society. That sounds like one answer too many. Of course, we could just pick one. There's a problem with that, though, serious enough to turn this choice into a dilemma. Making a straight choice amounts to losing half of our accumulated knowledge and wisdom. That would be foolhardy for sure. Yet if we don't make a choice, we seem to be left with an incoherent mess in our metaphysics. With all this going on, no wonder we're confused. I believe the conceptual tools needed to resolve this situation are available to us. Inspired by philosophical work in other areas, I have come to believe in a theory of love that can weave our embarrassment of riches into a coherent picture. The key is to show how social and biological accounts of love are not really in competition, but are complementary descriptions of a complex reality. Love has a dual nature. I suspect the failure to identify love's dual nature is responsible for much of our intellectual puzzlement about love. Even more worryingly, I suspect that it serves as a significant barrier to progress. Torn between the biological and social conceptions, we can easily fall back into the comforting arms of the romantic mystique, accepting love without understanding or challenging it. We may be held back from social critique by a niggling sense that love is a natural, biological phenomenon and as such not a suitable subject for such critique. Yet at the very same time, we may be held back in attempts to gain and disseminate a strong scientific understanding of love by a niggling sense that love is a cultural, or perhaps totally magical or incomprehensible phenomenon, and as such, not a suitable subject for scientific inquiry. In reality, neither concern should impede either project. Armed with a correct understanding of love's dual nature, biological and social theories of love can progress in tandem. They can inform and strengthen one another. We can have conversations about love that cross disciplinary boundaries in a way that unites rather than divides our various intellectual enterprises. In fact, we urgently need to do all this in order to make conscious and informed decisions about love. What do we want romantic love to look like 10 years from now, or 20, or 50? We must ask ourselves this question and act on the answer. We have to understand that the future of love is in our hands and that we have a responsibility to get this right. We can only undertake positive change as a collective enterprise, and empowering ourselves with the tools to think clearly about love is the essential first step. In the later chapters of this audiobook, after outlining my theory, I will sketch some of the ways the social aspect of love's nature is changing over time. I'll explore how we might want love to change, socially and perhaps even biologically, from what it is now. I'll talk about what it would take to move towards some of the practical, intellectual, and social benefits that I believe are within reach once we understand the dual nature of love. As for what kind of audiobook this is, perhaps it helps to start by saying what it's not. It's not relationship advice, self-help, or a collection of anecdotes. It's not an attempt to popularize science, nor is it an academic tome, and it's certainly not a survey or summary of all extant thinking about love. None of those would be a way of achieving what I'm trying to achieve, and the last one is impossible. I could call this audiobook an exercise in critical thinking out loud, but it's important to explain why I'm doing it out loud. Why does it matter if you hear it? Because we need a conversation, not a monologue. This conversation we need to have about the nature of romantic love is one of the most significant and urgent cultural projects of our shared moment in time. So much so that I am sometimes tempted to think of this audiobook as self-help for a culture rather than for individuals. When we, as a society, can come to a better understanding of what love is, we will be better able to take control of how love treats us in the future. So I'm inviting you to be an active listener. Not to passively absorb my ideas, but to question, challenge, and ultimately push these investigations far beyond anything I can imagine right now. I can't do the philosophy of love by myself. No one can. Ready to get started? Chapter 1. Love is biology. What is your substance? Whereof are you made, that millions of strange shadows on you tend? William Shakespeare, Sonnet 53. Dismantling the Romantic Mystique. There is a lot to be said for thinking of ourselves as human animals, a naturally occurring biological phenomenon amenable to scientific investigation like any other. Much of modern medicine owes its success to thinking of ourselves that way, and the dramatic increases in life expectancy and quality of life that have accompanied medical advancement make a pretty compelling case for this conception of what we are. That said, it's not surprising that romantic love, with all its poetic and magical associations, should be a holdout against the rising tide of naturalistic self-interpretation. The poet John Keats, writing in the early 19th century, held science responsible for the loss of the world's magic. In keeping with his time, he calls science philosophy. Science and philosophy were not separated into distinct enterprises until later. His sentiments strike a chord with many even today when he says, "Philosophy will clip an angel's wings and unweave a rainbow." For some people, romantic love has pride of place among a dwindling stock of intact rainbows. But there are risks inherent in treating love as an inexplicable mystery. The analogy with medicine shows why. If we want a good standard of medical care, we need medical science based on a solid grasp of human biology. That's not all we need for good medical care, but it is necessary. We can't achieve this knowledge if we treat our bodies as inexplicable and mysterious. If we don't even try to understand how our bodies work, we won't know how to fix them when they're broken. Romantic love is the same. Recent developments in the biology of love are providing valuable insights into how love works. Writers E.B. and K.S. White once quipped, "Humor can be dissected as a frog can, but the thing dies in the process, and the innards are discouraging to any but the pure scientific mind." Some might say the same is true of love, but they would be mistaken. There is actually huge public demand for scientific information about love. Its innards appear to be the opposite of discouraging. Moreover, this fascination has not left everyone's relationships dead on the dissecting table. In any case, there is no mileage to gain in standing at the edge of the rising tide of science, yelling at it to turn back and not dampen the gorgeous robes of poetry and magic we have dressed love up in. Scientists will continue to advance our understanding of love, whether we cheer them on or mourn the magic lost in the process. For what it's worth, I'll be among those doing the cheering. I think a better scientific understanding of love can help make us safer, healthier, and more aware of who and what we are. Love's biology. That doesn't mean we should just accept everything any scientist tells us about love. While I am fundamentally convinced of the need for a biological theory, many of the particular claims presented under the aegis of biology are suspect. As philosophers, we must approach the biology of love with both interest and caution. Helen Fisher is one of the most influential contemporary theorists of romantic love, which she treats as a thoroughly biological phenomenon. Fisher is a researcher, author, public speaker, and advisor to online dating service Match.com. Her work is a perfect spark for discussing the biology of love, and as such, I'll address it in some detail. But many other influential contemporary thinkers are also approaching love from the perspective of biology. For example, Sex at Dawn by Christopher Ryan and Cassilda Jatar has recently made a big impact on discussions of sex, romance, and relationships by framing these topics in terms of what is natural for our species given our biological makeup and evolutionary past. And this is not happening in a cultural or intellectual vacuum. The hope that biology can answer fundamental questions about us has been quite prevalent for some time, although it is perennially controversial. The basic idea that romantic love is a biological phenomenon is not new. Precedents stretch back to the ancient world, of which more later. More recently, Renaissance medicine attributed amorous dispositions and love melancholy to an imbalance in bodily fluids, the four humors. More recently still, philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer claimed that romantic love was just a grandiose label for sexual desire, itself a mere prompt to biological reproduction. The contemporary work of theorists like Fisher differs in that we may now be able to start getting the biology right. It's easy to see in retrospect that medicine based on the four humors was quackery and that Schopenhauer was an angry pessimist motivated by an alarming ideological agenda, one that included misogyny and homophobia. But Fisher is a serious researcher who's actually doing the science. Work like hers, we cannot dismiss so easily. It's one thing to say, love is biology of some kind or other. It's a whole different ballgame to step up and say, love consists of these specific biological mechanisms and here is the science to prove it. Fisher's work is a great starting point for discussion because it provides a clear, explicit, and most importantly, credible contemporary development of the idea that love is biology. Fisher thinks romantic love is literally identical to a biological drive, one identifiable by means of its evolutionary history and its role within the human body, and specifically the brain. So let's explore in a bit more detail what she says romantic love is and why. What drives us? In her influential book, Why We Love, The Nature and Chemistry of Romantic Love, Fisher discusses experiments that she and various collaborators conducted on individuals who said they had recently fallen intensely in love. Using functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, scans, they found that these individuals showed elevated activity in the caudate nucleus and ventral tegmental area, regions associated with the brain's reward system. Fisher reports finding that the reward-related neurotransmitter dopamine appeared to be implicated in producing some of the activities characteristic of intense romantic love, such as obsessive focus and energy directed at the beloved. There is also some evidence, although Fisher does not emphasize this, for the involvement of cortisol in the early stages of romantic love. Cortisol is associated with arousal and stress generally. The role of dopamine, however, is highly significant for Fisher. It supports her view that romantic love is a fundamental human drive, like our need for food and water, so she adds is the maternal instinct. Fisher thinks love is a basic biological urge that motivates us to do things that we as a species need to do in order to survive and thrive. She reasons that all of the basic drives are associated with elevated levels of dopamine. And so she counts the involvement of dopamine in romantic love as evidence that romantic love is likewise a basic drive. According to Fisher, it is in fact one of three primordial brain networks that evolved to direct mating and reproduction: lust, romantic love, and attachment. She reports that each of these travels along different pathways in the brain and is associated with different neurochemicals. Lust, she says, is associated primarily with testosterone, romantic love with dopamine, and attachment with oxytocin and vasopressin. Now, even if we want to accept a theory in this vicinity, there are some lurking philosophical questions concerning whether love should be identified with a drive, as Fisher suggests, or with, say, the brain states or neurochemical cocktails that result from that drive's activation. But I'm not going to worry about details like that for the purposes of this audiobook. I find much more relevant Fisher's separation of attachment from romantic love. My dispute with this might be verbal, but even so, it is one that matters. Words, in general, matter. Fisher's taxonomy is misleading. Her vocabulary is a mismatch for the way we usually talk about romantic love. An adequate, comprehensive theory of romantic love will need to cover many cases of what Fisher classifies as attachment. Stable, calm, attached love should not fail to count as romantic just because it is stable and calm, rather than intense and passionate like the early stage dopamine-driven phenomenon that Fisher identifies as romantic love. Indeed, the love at the end of some of the most romantic stories I know is the stable, calm kind. Renowned philosopher Robert Nozick, writing in the 1980s, thought of romantic love as going through two phases: an initial intense phase and a subsequent stable phase. While best known for his political philosophy, Nozick was also philosophically interested in romantic love, which he thought of as a desire for a certain kind of union with another person. He theorized that in its first stage, this desire would manifest as intense and passionate, while in its second stage, after the formation of the desired union, it would become settled and stable. Nozick's two-stage theory resonates with many, but it represents a disagreement with Fisher, who appears to classify only the first phase as romantic love. She would label the second phase as something else, attachment love. I disagree with Fisher. Attachment love can be romantic love. But that's not to say I agree with Nozick's two-stage view, at least not as a universal theory. It seems possible for romantic love to be calm and stable from the outset. Why not? Not all relationships have to begin with passion and fireworks. Sometimes old friends gradually and peacefully realize that they are more than just friends. This shouldn't disqualify theirs from counting as romantic love. It also seems possible for romantic love to be intense for its entire duration and to never settle down. And who's to say romantic love can't end up alternating back and forth between periods of calm and periods of intensity? Romantic love is not one size fits all, and an adequate theory simply has to deal with this. Both Fisher and Nozick are trying to make a very diverse phenomenon fit the confines of too narrow a mold. Anyhow, given that romantic love can sometimes take the form of what Fisher would call attachment, we need to include the science of attachment if we want to understand the science of romantic love in general. In this connection, Fisher and others have emphasized the role of the hormones oxytocin and vasopressin, and of the brain region known as the hypothalamus, which, along with the ovaries and testes, generates the relevant hormones in the human body. Where does love come from? To match her biological theory of what love is, Fisher offers a biological account of where it came from. Spoiler, evolution. She writes, "Each brain system evolved to direct a different aspect of reproduction. Lust evolved to motivate individuals to seek sexual union with almost any semi-appropriate partner. Romantic love emerged to drive men and women to focus their mating attention on a preferred individual. And the brain circuitry for male-female attachment developed to enable our ancestors to live with this mate at least long enough to rear a single child through infancy together." She later expands on this idea, saying that the arrival of bipedalism in our evolutionary history caused a problem for females. They became obliged to carry their babies in their arms instead of on their backs. And so they began to need mates to help feed and protect them, at least while they carried and nursed a child. Fisher proposes this as the evolutionary explanation for pair bonding, and hence romantic love, in our species. She reasons that because a female would need a male to provide for her, pair bonding became essential for females. And she figures a male couldn't protect or provide for a harem of females, so pair bonding also became practical for males. We know the end of the story. Monogamy, the human habit of forming a pair bond with one individual at a time, evolved. There's a lot of philosophical work to be done here. For one thing, we need to appreciate the impact of the heteronormative culture within which Fisher is working, and I'll come back to this later. For now, I want to make an initial separation between two things that come wrapped up together in Fisher's work: the fascinating scientific results she is discussing and has herself been at the forefront of achieving, and her metaphysical theorizing as to the nature of romantic love. The latter is a branch of philosophy, and in general, scientific expertise does not guarantee that one's philosophical theories will be correct. The scientific results, Fisher reports, includes things like the observations obtained by means of fMRI scans, revealing that certain areas of the brain are more active in individuals who report being newly and intensely in love. The philosophical theorizing takes over when Fisher goes on to say that romantic love is, of its essence, a basic biological drive that evolved because our helpless female ancestors needed monogamous males to provide for them while they reared their babies. Of course, Fisher's results and her theorizing are connected. She takes her results to be evidence for her philosophical theory. "Our results changed my thinking about the very essence of romantic love," as she puts it. For example, as we saw, she points to the involvement of dopamine in both romantic love and all other basic human drives as a reason to believe that love is itself a basic human drive. But as philosophers, we must bear in mind that along with data, personal and cultural experiences in the arena of love are inevitably also part of what goes into the act of theorizing about love. Fisher, like anybody, is much more likely to believe in a theory of love that is consonant with her own experiences. This is not a criticism. It is reasonable and rational to be more favorably inclined towards a theory that makes sense of one's own experiences. And there is simply no way for us to be inquirers, whether that amounts to being a philosopher, a biologist, an anthropologist, or simply a curious person, without also being humans. We bring our humanity and our experience to all our intellectual pursuits, and these impact how we proceed in those pursuits. The real risk is not that this will happen, but that if we ignore it, if we downplay the involvement of the personal and the cultural in the intellectual, we are ignoring some of the most powerful factors that shape the work of scientists, philosophers, and everyone else. I find Fisher's philosophical theory unconvincing, in part because it is so dissonant with experiences of love drawn from my life and the lives of people I know. I'll say more about this later. For now, it's enough to note that we don't have to agree with all the details of Fisher's metaphysical theorizing about love to appreciate why her scientific work is important. It is very hard to deny that the results she has identified tell us something significant about the biological nature of love. So let's focus for a moment on what that is. What is real? The big idea motivating Fisher, a biological theory of romantic love based on isolating the neurochemistry and neurophysiology involved, is on the right track. If we want to understand what love is, we will need to listen to the people studying our bodies and brains in controlled and data-driven ways that can be tested, peer-reviewed, reproduced, and verified, and that deliver measurable results. We will need to learn the science of love. We should respect science's successful track record in bringing us to a better understanding of ourselves. Reading the experimental work conducted by Fisher and others, I find it hard to resist the pull toward concluding that romantic love is something natural, biological, and scientifically investigable, something hardwired into our biology and brain chemistry, ready to be triggered under certain circumstances, with the full force of an evolutionary history behind it. If this is right, there are limits to how fully we will ever understand love just by studying culture, literature, or art. If love is a biological phenomenon, the scientific method has the right credentials for investigating such a thing. Mapping cultural trends in love, however fascinating in other ways, will not give us the necessary grasp of love's biological profile. Biology got there first. Our dopamine and cortisol responses were developing long before anything like the complex structure of contemporary society existed. And biology persists through cultural change. Attitudes and opinions about love come and go, but our brain circuitry stays relatively constant across the centuries. All of this means that we need to understand the biology of love not just for formulating a proper theory of what love is now, but also for thinking about what love has been in the past and what it could be in the future. Moreover, while brain circuitry is relatively stable over time, we are acquiring new ways of interfering with it as our knowledge advances. Ethicists and scientists are already debating the possible impacts of medical interventions that may be able to alter how, when, or even whether love occurs. Certain drugs may be able to enhance or encourage the biological responses characteristic of love, while others, sometimes called chemical breakup drugs, may be able to lessen or prevent these responses. This isn't wild science fiction. It is already a realistic possibility. For example, testosterone, oxytocin, and vasopressin are being discussed as drugs that might increase the likelihood of love occurring or continuing, while antagonists for oxytocin, vasopressin, or dopamine are being considered as ways of reducing that likelihood. In the future, it may be possible to intervene in the biology of love in yet more dramatic ways. There is evidence that epigenetic effects, environmental influences on gene expression, which are sometimes heritable, can be used to regulate pair bonding in mammals. In prairie voles, for example, certain epigenetic mechanisms have been found to enhance pair bonding in the absence of a more usual mechanism, sex. Perhaps one day we'll be able to manipulate human pair bonding in similar ways. Perhaps we'll be able to alter the composition of our own brains so as to render ourselves incapable of love. Perhaps we'll bring falling in and out of love under total control, rendering it as simple as opening and closing an app on our smartphones. Should medical interventions to encourage or suppress love be permitted? Should they be regulated? Would it devalue love to know that it had been artificially enhanced? Would we stand to lose something valuable? opportunities for learning or personal growth, maybe, by exercising chemical control at love's most difficult moments? Would it be worth paying that price to avoid the misery of intense long-term feelings for inappropriate or abusive partners? What about using drugs to get over someone who is just not that into you? We need to be having conversations about these issues, and I'll circle back to some of them near the end of this audiobook. But the salient point here is that we need to understand the biology of love even to get as far as figuring out what questions to ask about all of this. That's one reason why appreciating the biological nature of love is important. It empowers us to think clearly about the future of love, balancing what we want to do against what we actually can do. Cocktail recipes. We first need to appreciate that, at the biological level, love exhibits significant variation. Even Fisher, one of the most prominent advocates of a biological theory of love, is not saying that the biology of love looks exactly the same in everyone. The data tell us that there are statistically significant correlations between reported experiences of romantic love and things like heightened activity in certain areas of the brain or elevated levels of certain brain chemicals. But exactly how much activity in which areas and exactly how much of which chemicals, all this is subject to interpersonal variation. You might hear love described metaphorically as a cocktail of chemicals. But if love is a cocktail, it has no single strict recipe. It's better conceived of as a family of cocktails. Consider daiquiris. You'd expect to find a few basic ingredients in a daiquiri, some kind of rum, some sort of citrus juice, usually lime, and some sort of sweetener, usually sugar. But individual daiquiris vary the ratios, and some include other ingredients like strawberries or bananas. Other daiquiris get creative and replace the rum with another spirit. The brain chemistry for love is similarly variable. What's more, there's nothing at all surprising about this. All humans belong to a single species, but we differ in the details of our biological makeup. We exhibit variation in all kinds of traits, from obvious things like eye color and arm length to less obvious things like fingerprints and DNA. There is no one way to have a human biology. Romantic love is no exception to the rule. Just as in the biology of love, in the psychology of love, we see significant diversity between individuals. To pick just one type of example, researchers recently found that in two samples of long-term married couples, 29 and 40% of participants reported still being very intensely in love after more than 10 years of marriage. The study identified correlations with various other psychological and behavioral factors. Another study found that reports of long-term intense romantic love correlated with certain patterns of brain activity. These findings are intriguingly in tension with the philosophical theory of love offered by Robert Nozick. Remember that he said romantic love is a two-stage business. It passes through a brief, passionate first stage to reach a long-term, calm second stage. The first stage, which Nozick calls infatuation, is supposed to transform into continuing love or else disappear. But someone who feels very intensely in love after 10 years of marriage doesn't fit comfortably into either of Nozick's two boxes. Interpersonal variation is no barrier to proper scientific understanding, however. In fact, when carefully handled, the science of love serves to protect us against making unscientific overgeneralizations that float free of empirical data. The scientific method, properly applied, cautions us not to overinterpret the limited data we have. Science will save us. Isn't there something intellectually comforting about the idea that science can finally tell us what love really is? Isn't it reassuring to think that we might finally get some answers through the application of tried and trusted experimental methods to our deepest and most perplexing questions about love? It is to me. Love can make people behave in such strange ways and exerts such a formative influence in so many people's lives. Yet it's been treated as irredeemably mysterious for so long that we've come to regard bafflement as a normal state of affairs. It is awfully tempting and not unrealistic to hope that science will finally dispel the romantic mystique. The kinds of answers we get from the science of love really do seem to explain a lot when it comes to things like the strange behaviors that love can induce. Studies are revealing important biochemical similarities between the brains of people who are intensely in love and those of people experiencing chemical addiction. Fisher describes some of these results in a TED Talk titled The Brain in Love, in which she explains how she and her colleagues found that romantic love is linked with activity in the ventral tegmental area, particularly the A10 cells, which make dopamine. She refers to this as part of the reptilian core of the brain, associated with wanting, with motivation, with focus, and with craving. As she points out, the very same brain region also gets activated during a cocaine rush. A biological approach to the nature of love has a lot going for it. It promises relatively clear and straightforward answers to the old question, what is love? We could say love is a kind of neurochemical cocktail, or better, family of cocktails. Or we could say, with Fisher, that love is a basic drive, like hunger or thirst, that evolved in our evolutionary past to use these chemical cocktails to get us to behave in ways that promoted the survival of our species. These biological theories offer real explanatory value and help make sense of what people in love go through. Love can feel like addiction because it can biochemically resemble addiction. Love is powerfully motivating because it evolved for an important purpose. We can rigorously test and refine the information on which this kind of theory rests, using methodologies that have proven their value in many areas of science. On top of all that, the biological approach to love has important practical implications. When discussing how we might want love to change, particularly when it comes to using biochemical interventions to encourage or suppress love, we have to start out with a good grasp of love's biological nature, or we'll be wasting our breath. Will science save us? And yet, there's an and yet. Taking a purely biological approach to love raises some tricky issues. For starters, we need to ask a few questions about methodology. Current scientific research on romantic love relies heavily on self-reporting. When selecting study participants who are in love, researchers take their cue from what people tell them. This can be a problem, as people might not be fully accurate, honest, or consistent in this kind of self-reporting for all kinds of reasons, some idiosyncratic, some systematic, some deliberate, some unintentional. There are also philosophical concerns that run deeper than method. If we say that love is biology, literally a feature of our biological makeup, then we appear to be committed to saying that any creature with a radically different makeup from ours cannot be in love. Maybe other animals with enough similarities in their evolutionary pasts could be candidates, but we would be ruling out the possibility of an artificially intelligent computer or robot falling in love. Regardless of how sophisticated the technology becomes, computers and robots would not share enough of our biology or evolutionary history. By the lights of a biological theory of love, the plot of the movie Her, in which a man seems to fall in love with his computer operating system, or OS, and vice versa, would be no more than a story about a deeply confused individual. His OS cannot love him. An OS is incapable of love because it is not a biological organism, and love is a biological phenomenon. Maybe that sounds just right to you. Perhaps you agree that a computer OS could not be in love. But what about other possible creatures with very different biologies and evolutionary histories? What about aliens? Or what about designer life forms that didn't evolve at all but were brought into existence through direct human agency? If love is indeed a feature of human biology, then all these other creatures can never be in love. Now, perhaps you're not too worried about aliens and designer life forms either. After all, we don't exactly bump into them on a daily basis. But do we really want a theory of love to tie our hands on these questions about what's possible? Do we want to buy into a theory that limiting before all the facts are in about what we might encounter in the future? Maybe a biological theorist of love can do some fancy philosophical footwork and find a way to avoid these theoretical constraints. These issues arise in other areas of philosophy too. For example, in the investigation of what pain is. And metaphysicians of the mind are already at work developing ingenious solutions. But another serious issue lurks. A purely biological theory of romantic love doesn't properly accommodate the role of culture and society. A purely biological theory predicts that cultural influences play a negligible to non-existent role in determining the nature of romantic love. Our biology is not in any substantial way a product of society or culture. So if love is part of our biology, love is not in any substantial way a product of society or culture. This would mean we must reject claims like romantic love has changed a lot over the last few hundred years and is still changing, or romantic love differs radically between cultures. Ancient evolved brain chemistry and fundamental human drives don't differ radically among cultures and don't change much in the space of a few hundred years. So why does romantic love seem to vary so much across time and across cultures if it is a biological phenomenon? This is the one big question to which a simple biological theory of love cannot give any answer that I would find satisfying. The theory predicts some individual variation in different people's cocktail recipes for love, but biology alone cannot adequately explain these large-scale variations that look like they are tracking cultural differences. A biological theory of love can be intellectually satisfying in a number of ways and practically important for making informed ethical choices. But if you're anything like me, it just doesn't feel like the whole story. In the next chapter, I expand on the themes of change and intercultural variation as I examine the case for saying that romantic love is not a biological phenomenon after all, but rather a socially constructed one.